actually. This month, we've only got two agenda papers to discuss for the impairment sessions. The one is the follow-up on the paper we had in November for our loan commitments and financial guarantees paper, and then we've got a paper on transition. So we are almost there, and we will talk about the disclosures in January when we meet again next year. So I will start on agenda paper 5A. Now, at the November meeting, we presented a paper on loan commitments and financial guarantees, saying that for overall for loan commitments and financial guarantees, respondents agreed with using estimating expected losses over the maximum period of the contractual period, so not going beyond that contractual period, although you could use a shorter behavioral life period if that was applicable. But for revolving credit facilities, because an entity does not have the practical ability really to cancel that facility within the 1 day contractual notice period that it has, that contractual period is actually, it's not reflecting the exposure to credit risk that an entity has on these revolving facilities. And the board then tentatively decided to allow for revolving credit the behavioral life to extend beyond the contractual life. So to capture that period over which you don't have the practical ability to cancel the undrawn balance. But at that meeting, you asked us to consider whether that same principle or that exception of the behavioral life going beyond the contractual life applies to other kinds of loan commitments as well, and whether we should make this applicable to more loan commitments than just revolving credits. In our paper, we've considered two examples of very common loan commitments, one being a fixed period loan commitment, so it's only applicable or available for a fixed period and it's not a revolving facility, and the other one where you can cancel the facility but it's conditional, so only if something happens you can cancel that facility. The staff recommendation on this issue is to not extend the decision from the November meeting to all loan commitments, and to say for a loan commitment the maximum period is the contractual period, except for revolving credits or other facilities where you don't have the practical ability to cancel within that period, that then the behavioral life can extend beyond the contractual period. But we also, two other recommendations we are making is just on the discount rate. Similar to revolving credits, there are other loan commitments for which an entity knows what the EIR would be, or there's already an asset on the balance sheet for which the EIR is applicable. So for those, we are saying, or we are recommending that they can use the same EIR to discount the undrawn balance or the loan commitments. And on presentation, we're also recommending to just extend that to all loan commitments and saying, if you can't distinguish expected losses on the drawn balance from that on the undrawn balance, you can present them together by setting it off on the asset first and then taking it, whatever's left down, to being presented as a provision. So with that, I'll hand it over to you for discussion.
Darrell?
I agree with the recommendations in 22 and 23. I still have a concern around the staff recommendation in paragraph 21, which is the other than revolving credit facilities. And I think, Rihanna, in a lot of your tee up there, you referred to the principle which I think is behind this decision, which is those circumstances where you have a contractual term that is very short, but that the termination of the contract is unenforceable for practical reasons. I think that's the right principle. I think that's absolutely correct. I'm concerned that by simply focusing on revolving facilities, we're not getting the principle across. Now, I understand that it's a practical thing from us. It's an easy one to look at. But if I jump back to your example one, and in example one, you sort of clarified example one in paragraph 10 by saying it was a fixed period loan commitment, but you can't withdraw again once you've repaid on this example. So we've got a fixed term, we know exactly when the term is. The bank will revisit that at the end of the fixed term, fine. If I were to take out that restriction that you placed on there and said, in fact, what can happen is if I early repay some of that loan, I have the opportunity to withdraw it again. it becomes what many people would consider a revolving facility, but it's not one that we will want subject to this behavioural life. We'd want to say that it should last until the period at the end. So it feels to me like we perhaps need both conditions in, revolving, and the fact that you mustn't have there must exist that lack of a practical ability to terminate the contract. And it seems to me that if the bank or the entity doing the lending is sitting down and reconsidering the loan, even if there is a high likelihood that that loan will continue to be renewed at each period, the fact that the bank is able to sit down and make that decision means that the contractual life is correct.
Yes.
And all we're trying to identify is those where that's not able to happen.
Yes, because I think the reason we focused on revolving credit facilities was we didn't want to create the situation where you have a loan commitment or even a financial asset on the balance sheet which just it's being rolled over on a continuous basis, so the behavioural life becomes longer than just what the contract says. But for those, there's a conscious decision to roll it over or to extend it, and you've got the ability to reprice. So we tried to, that's why we focus on revolving credits, is to say that it's different from the others.
And I think the only point I'd make is that we need to just be careful that even the term revolving credit wouldn't be too broad in the context of it. There are loans like your example 10 slightly adjusted, your example 1 slightly adjusted, which I think might be considered revolving, but we wouldn't want in this category.
Yeah.
Okay.
I guess that might just be wording, but I think you teed it up to my mind correctly, but it's not necessarily recommended for it.
So you don't disagree with what the proposal is, it's rather clarifying words.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do we agree?
Can I ask a question? I was just wondering whether trade receivables qualify as revolving credit.
No.
Why would you think they do?
Well, it kind of has some similarities. I've got an account and I'm making purchases and I can go up to a certain limit.
At each receivable, or each time you add to the receivable, there's a transaction.
Yes.
Okay, that's fine. I just wanted to make sure that I could foresee some complications if they were.
Okay, no. The intention was not to include them.
Fine.
Do we agree with the staff's recommendation?
Yes.
Okay. Just a question about the FSB's view on this topic. What is going, what the FSB is going to do with this? Because it has a material impact on the credit card facilities, and we know it's very significant. So what's our colleagues' view?
They haven't discussed it yet.
I think at this stage we don't know, because they have not yet discussed any of this, and we're still waiting for them to have their final discussion. So
they're aware of our decisions.
The question will come to us and to them.
They are aware about
it. The level playing field will be raised. That's a big issue.
I'd be surprised if they hadn't had the same feedback.
Yeah.
Okay, next paper.
Okay, so paper 5B. The paper discusses the staff recommendation on how the entity needs to transition from IAS 39 today to the new proposals of expected credit losses. The paper describes the proposals that we included in the exposure draft and the arguments the ISB considered in making those proposals. The majority of the respondents supported these transition requirements. Some requested that the ISB consider more practical ways to assess whether there has been a significant increase in credit risk at the date of transition. This was to address the concern that the proposals, as was included in the ED, would result in all instruments that are below low credit risk and for which the entity does not have information about the initial credit risk would essentially be measured at lifetime expected credit losses. The vast majority of respondents supported retrospective application of the proposals without requiring the restatement of comparators. Accordingly, we do not intend to reconsider this part of the proposal and recommend that these proposals are confirmed. The paper analyzes the information the staff consider would be available without undue cost and effort, and what relief could be provided. The staff also considered recent decisions of the ISB on more practical ways to assess significant increase in credit risk. Before just giving the staff recommendation, I think, having read the paper, if you look at it, what we're really trying to achieve is say, ideally, first, retrospective application. If you're not able to do that, what do we think are the easy instruments to identify, either be they in stage one or stage two, and then for the remaining group, which is actually the issue, try and get that approximation of credit risk. If you're not able to get that, then unfortunately you're in the last requirement that says if it's not low credit risk, lifetime. So that's the theme. And accordingly, the staff recommends that the ISB confirm that at the date of transitions, entity may apply the low credit risk criteria to identify instruments for which the credit risk has not significantly increased, and the rebuttable presumption for contractual payments that are more than 30 days past due to identify the instruments that have experienced significant increases in credit risk. Furthermore, we recommend that the ISB include a more practical way to determine significant increase in credit risk to consider the credit risk of the asset at the date of transition and compare to the criteria on origination of that financial asset type. This is consistent with the decision the board took in October, where you decided that the assessment of significant increases in credit risk could be implemented more simply by establishing the initial maximum credit risk for a particular portfolio, either by product type or by region, known as the origination credit risk, and then comparing the credit risk of financial instruments of that portfolio at the reporting date with that on origination. For the remainder of instruments, we recommend to clarify that the entity should use the best available information without undue cost or effort to obtain or approximate the credit risk on initial recognition. The entity would then use this information to determine whether significant increases in credit risk had occurred. If that entity is not able to determine or approximate the credit risk on initial recognition, and that it is not low credit risk, the entity should measure the allowance at lifetime expected credit losses. With that, I open the floor.
I have only a question.
Yes.
In 29, you are saying if the entity is not able to determine or approximate the credit risk on initial recognition, yes, the entity should measure the loss allowance at the lifetime expected credit loss. Shouldn't it be reading that? And if it is not low credit risk, then it should be lifetime. Yeah. Is that missing in this paragraph?
I think it's missing. However, if you go through all the steps, you would have already
maybe you come to
that.
The conclusion.
So it's after all of that, that's the last step. So you're right in that assessment, but you would have already identified them.
Okay, thanks.
Mary?
Kind of connected to the same point. If you were not able to determine an approximation of the original, and therefore you had to start out with lifetime losses, I would expect the question would come up about can I judge this to have improved in such a way that it moves out of two back into one if, for example, its rating improves enough so that it then is rated as low credit risk. And my instinct is that if you can't determine a transition, even an approximation of what the origination date was, then as you say in 29, your lifetime until you derecognize it, and you can't say that subsequently crossing back to low credit risk is enough of an improvement to take you out of stage two. But I one way or another, I think we've got to address that. Can you, if you use this backstop, can you improve out of it?
No.
That's a good question.
I don't need an answer.
I think in the first bit, I want to say no, almost, because I don't know how you're going to assess improvement because you didn't know where you started.
Right.
But I'm wondering about the second bit that you mentioned about if you improve and you know it's low credit risk at that point.
Because I think somebody would look at this and said, okay, if your proxy for being in stage one is low credit risk at date of transition, does achieving low credit risk later move you back into stage one? I think we just have to answer that.
Stephen?
My concern with this is we're giving too much flexibility in that companies will be able to pick and choose. So 26B2 So if you declare that you're using past due to assess increases in credit risk, then you get to book, you get to put into stage one on transaction anything that's not past due. If you declare that you're not using past due and you don't have the information to do retrospective, then all of those that would have been in stage one get into stage two and get lifetime allowances. And that's potentially going to be a very big difference on transition depending upon that. And this is likely, I think, to be the biggest driver of profitability or P&L impact post-transition. So this, to my mind, is a really big deal.
Do you want to?
yeah, I can. I think when the way we thought about it is, if you are going to use delinquency and this 30 days past due rebuttable presumption to manage credit risk going forward and to identify significant increases in credit risk, you can apply it on transition. But we were also concerned that someone may just apply it on transition, even if that's not the way they're going to do it going forward. So personally, I would say you can only do the rebuttable presumption on transition if you're going to use it for that portfolio going forward. I don't think you can apply it to anything and then change the way you look at it afterwards.
What if somebody uses delinquency as their primary indicator of deterioration but supplements it with other information as and when available? What happens then? Are they using the 30 days past due as their primary? Are they assessing according to 30 days past due or not, when it is primarily that information, but maybe some other things, if they've got it? That's kind of sort of falling in between the two, it seems to me, and I'm not sure whether I'd be in 26B2 or not.
But if, well, the way the rebuttable presumption is worded is saying you don't have any other borrower-specific information. All you have is delinquency. And we're saying if you've got other information, you need to use that, and you can't then just rely on the 30 days past due. You have to apply the other information. So it would it not be the same on transition then?
Maybe. My other concern is this is going to encourage the use of 30 days past due and for people not to look for other information if they want to minimize the impact on transition. Of course, if you want to go the opposite direction and you've got enough capital to absorb it and you want to maximize post the profits afterwards, then you'll just find a little bit of extra information. It just seems to me that this opens the door to managing the transition and hence managing future profitability.
What's your suggestion, Steve? Because if you think back on the history of how we got here in the first place, because this was in the ED, I think it was your idea at the time, actually. My memory serves me well. But we wanted to minimise the risk of people applying it on an absolute basis too broadly, and so we clarified that you could assess significant increases in credit risk. Well, that if you had delinquency information, that was one way of determining whether you had a significant increase in credit risk or not. So we tried to put it in sort of initially, I think, as a sort of clarification that we thought in lots of cases you could retrospectively apply it and didn't need to use absolute because you had delinquency information. So that's sort of the history of how it came in here, to sort of encourage the proper application retrospectively of the model rather than defaulting to an absolute model, which wasn't our preference for the overall structure. So do you have a suggestion, given that background, for how we could better position this delinquency, I guess, to try and balance those two competing concerns?
Well, I wonder whether we shouldn't say apply retrospectively and use your best endeavours to do the best job you can with the information that's available to faithfully identify what's deteriorated and what hasn't.
And by the way, sometimes that could include using delinquency information. Because I think that was what the sort of background was. It was a
rather than giving this implicit choice that's in here.
I think we could rebalance it that way, which I think is more consistent with its history.
Because I think we just wanted to acknowledge that there is this interaction with the 30 days, and we need to acknowledge it, because I think the feedback from the exposure draft was definitely people are feeling we are missing the link, and to just clarify how it does interrelate. But I mean, we've been scared when even drafting this that we don't want to create the idea that we are missing 30 days past due as a perfect measure. Like, that was not the intention. So
I think it would be fair to reposition it, because it was the original idea retrospective application, you know, one way of thinking about significant deterioration is 30 days past due. So, yeah.
Okay, Philippe. Could the staff clarify for me how the second sentence in paragraph 27 would work? Here we assume that the entity doesn't track the evolution of credit risk for the portfolio. So at the date of transition, we have to find ways alternatively. But you say, okay, you look at the credit quality applicable for financial assets of the relevant type at the time. How does that work? If you don't track credit quality, how can you look at assets of relevant type? I mean, it's a bit void to me, this sentence.
Just to confirm, this is the paragraph 27 that talks about the October decision.
Yeah, but then you see, you go on saying the same thing that it would be helpful to acknowledge. So it's an amplification of that October decision. And here I have a sentence which looks good, but seems to be a bit void in content, because I don't see how you can do that. If you don't track credit quality changes, how can you look at assets of the relevant type at the day they were originated?
So this ties into, so the decision in October and how it would apply, for example, is certain entities would have a policy that they won't originate lower than, let's say, in their internal rating system, rating 10. At transition, you'll find the rating is 12. Now, you don't originate at that. You know you don't originate anything at 10, for example. So 12, therefore, in your mind, is significant increase in credit risk. That's one example. Or sometimes entities are able to group portfolios and know this whole portfolio was 3, and now it is a 5. And they said that was a significant increase in credit risk. So they might not perfectly track it, but they have some correlation that they can do. And I think this is why it would be, I don't know, application guidance or something in the drafting that we just say, it, consistent with October, this is a way you can do it on transition, but it's not actually requiring perfect information, but it does require more information than nothing.
That's fine, but I think you have in the drafting to be more specific than what you said in this sentence, because having read it several times, I did not really understand how it could work in practice, you know, if you don't give the explanations of the kind you just gave.
Yeah, I think we will refer back to the wording we've agreed in October. So the way it was set out in our October recommendation about determining the maximum origination credit risk, and that you can use that on transition as well.
And I think in October we discussed that it was probably best illustrated using an example rather than using too many specific words, because it's hard to be precise enough about how it ties in with the concept. I think PK raised it at the time. So maybe what we could do is, as part of that example, illustrate how also it could be relevant as a transition thing, and do it that way.
I have another very small point. This might be a typo in this paper or a typo in the basis for conclusions of the ED, but if you look at page 2, paragraph 5, we quote DC 152.
Yes.
We talk about an improvement in credit quality. It seems to me it's a deterioration. So is this the basis for conclusions which had the typo, or this paper? I don't know.
It might be a typo.
PK?
I'll have to double check.
PK? I did raise my thing after Mary raised that issue, and I acknowledge that I had a similar question that Mary had, but I think, just to make sure myself absolutely clear, on the date of transition, you're going to hit the retained earnings, not the income statement. So there is a potential room for games if you allow, which is a valid point, because once you are in it, because this is a backdrop, like somebody said it, I think I agree with Steve. When I was reading this paper, I felt like, no, this is like, please get onto the highway one way or the other. You know, you can be a slip road, bypass, whatever you want to get onto, but get onto the highway of impairment. So once we have done that, I think this one, we should not change to anything other than lifetime once you have established a lifetime. And I would recommend not to think about the, there is a good question to ask, like, you know, what if it becomes a low credit? But I think we should stick this simple. The way I look at it is like a purchased impaired loans, PCI. You are there. You got onto that highway. Otherwise, I can see a little bit of games playing can be played here.
Okay.
And it'll be easy to think, let's go to the backdrop, let's not work too hard, let's go to lifetime, because any improvement from there, I can take it to income statement. So people, it can create some incentives.
And it was for that reason that we thought we should make some changes to, or, you know, clarify how that you can apply approximations, or you know, there are other ways to do it, because the risk was the way it is in the ED. If it's not low credit risk, then it has to be lifetime on transition. But if it then gets better, you get all of the releases from
the income statement. Yeah. But you have given this to people to say, you know, this is absolutely the last backstop. So once you got to, once you use that option, stick to that.
And then I just want to go back and clarify, Sue, on your back and forth with Steve about how we'd sharpen up paragraph 26. Would that then knock out the notion of if it's not low credit, then your lifetime? Because what I heard you two saying was, what, you know, one way or another, you've got to do an approximation?
No.
Okay.
If you just can't, then the low credit risk cut would still apply.
With the suggestions for wording improvements, can we support the staff recommendations?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, Gil, this is the last time you are with us.
Wait. Second question.
Are there any additional points besides the ones that have already been raised?
I just wanted to make an observation, Hans.
Yes,
there. In E, we talk about the effects of proposed disclosures, and we're going to be talking about them next month. So I just want to emphasize the following. And that is the discussion that Stephen raised, as well as I think the acknowledgement the staff makes in paragraph 34D, that this model is not perfect. It's not going to necessarily result in resolving the age-old issue of too little, too late, right? Particularly in an extremist situation. I think it really puts a lot of value and weight on the quality of the disclosure. So in the effects analysis, I think we should emphasize there is great potential here for the removal of boilerplate disclosures, and I make that assertion based on my own personal review of the disclosures in the financial statements of large major bank holding companies, and the substitution with much more decision useful information, one of which would be to track the movements in the allowances for loan losses. I think it's absolutely critical. I've been amazed, actually, at the dearth of really useful information in the financial statements of companies over the last few years on this topic, when this is the biggest asset on their balance sheet. So.
Mary?
Question about 34A. One of the suggestions was to include quantitative information from the field work undertaken, and I just wanted to flag up that I think we should figure out what we're doing more generally in effects analysis. I assume that the working group we've had on effects analysis would have considered whether or not this is the kind of information that should be included and not make a one-off decision in this project. So either we're always going to try to or we're not.
Just maybe a suggestion for you to think about. I was a little bit concerned with 34D. Talking about limitations of the model, so maybe a different view. I don't know if it's in aligned with Pat's, but I think we should stress the objectives of the model, considering the objectives of the IFRS. So we have a little bit of this in our base for conclusion when explore the different objectives of IFRS, consider the final beneficiaries and users, and other objectives such as regulators in the financial sector and prudential rules. So instead of using the word limitation, I would, if it's necessary, to expand here in addition to what we already have in the base for conclusion, we keep the same line, the distinct objectives, not the limitation of the model.
What we haven't sought to capture, in a sense.
Exactly. Because I guess what we are, the preparers were talking here is somewhat related to economic cycles and procyclicality, things like that, that it's much more in the prudential. It's not our objective here.
Yes. And I think, Yossi, maybe that was a bit strong wording from our side, but I think it's true what you say about the economic cycle, because definitely the information that users or preparers were really scared of, that people think they can perfectly predict the financial crisis of 2008. And they almost just want to acknowledge, or wanted to acknowledge, that that's not how business can do it. So
I agree with that.
If they could perfectly predict it, they would not make those loans.
Yeah. Stephen. Just on 34A and this quantitative information about the effects, I'm a bit nervous about being too definitive on this. I mean, I'm confident that IAS 39 allowances is a subset of the new allowance in terms of the way we've written the standard, but what the effect is in practice is very uncertain, and the evidence we have, to my mind, is no more than anecdotal, maybe a little bit more than that, but attaching too much reliability, I'd be very nervous of putting a number in this.
Yeah. And I think from the staff side, the general consensus almost, I don't think it would be able to include quantitative information, because if you think we write one global standard, I can't tell the board one single global answer for the impact, because it differs too much across the world and how people did it. So, but I think our focus will probably be on a lot of qualitative information that we got from the field work that gives maybe input in direction, but not give a percentage for it. So.
Okay. Any more suggestions?
Well, Gil, then it's time for us to say goodbye to you. We thank you for your cheerful presence in this building, and you did some useful work as well. Thank you very much. You're going back to KPMG in South Africa. We wish you all the best.